Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go. We wrap it up. And I'm as excited as I am every Tuesday night when we hit this show. We've started out in Denver, Colorado with Kim Blylevin talking candid. Then we went to Cleveland, Ohio with Peter Ray and sitting down with Sudden Sam McDowell and his new book coming out tomorrow out there in Cleveland. And now we hit Pittsburgh and the 412. This is the podcast hosted by my good brothers, David Finoli, Chris Fletcher, yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing it, 347-205-9631. Goes by quick. You can catch the archive on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of them, less of me, let me lay the groundwork down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. First of all, David, how are you? Congrats last night in Fresno. Second of all, you got your sidekick to the left of you and Chris. And third of all, you're bringing two great guests in here like you always do each and every Tuesday. So I'll just sit back and man the board for you, my friend.
No, thank you very much. Good evening, although we're back to a cold evening in Pittsburgh after a couple balmy 60-degree days. I can be reached on Facebook at David Finoli, F-I-N-O-L-I, and on Twitter at D Finoli. I have my Duquesne brother with me as always, Chris Fletcher. Chris, I know you are thoroughly excited about the fact that for the first time in the history of college basketball in the great city of Pittsburgh, all three Division I teams have lost 20 games in a season.
Yeah, we've hit a new low. You know, of course, Duquesne's been pulling their part of that for quite some time now. It was about time that the other two kicked in.
Well, it was. It was a little selfish on Pitt's part not to pull too many 20-loss seasons, but they finished their year today showing people that we're all in to lose 20 with a 20-point loss to Boston College in the ACC tournament. But, boy, I'm just glad the season's I don't think Duquesne's in the A-10 tournament. I don't think they all make it there. Maybe I'm wrong, but hopefully I'm not.
It's been a rough year for basketball, but you know, there was some good news on the Pitt campus this week, though. Three of their wrestlers did very well, winning ACC crowns. You had Cole Matthews at the 141, Jake Wenzel at 165, and Nina Bonacorsi at 197. So congratulations to the wrestlers there over at Pitt. That's at least some good news, and you know, we're still waiting for some baseball news of some sort, but what can you do?
Well, on the good end, Pitt did defeat Ohio State on a walk-off home run. So that is some good baseball news, as they got off to a 7-4 start so far.
I'll tell you, Dave, Heather Lyk has really done a great job with the other sports. I mean, not so much with the basketball, but really Pitt standings, you know, with soccer, with tennis, with swimming, with volleyball and wrestling, they've all been top notch.
Yeah, no, she's done a great job. If only she can figure out a way to get men's and women's basketball under her belt, she'd be pretty near perfect. But if I had my druthers, Fletch, between basketball or football, I'd take football every time. And Lord knows I'm enjoying spring practice starting.
Yeah, it was good to see, wasn't it? And I think they have more talent than people think that they do. I'm excited for this team.
I think they are very close to becoming a constant top 15 team, so I agree with you. But, you know, tonight, I love nothing more than a good baseball movie, as I know you do too. And
indeed.
Tonight we have the man who wrote the screenplay for one of my favorite all-time movies about, I know, our shared greatest pirate of all time, Roberto Clemente. The movie is Chasing 3000, and the man who wrote the screenplay, which was about a story in his life. Bill Makita is with us. Bill, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me this evening. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, awesome, awesome. I'll tell you what. Why don't you talk a little about the movie and more importantly, about the story you shared with your brother in St. Clemente's 3000th game.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it started with me in, like many people, with an event in my life where my mother died fairly suddenly of a brain tumor, and she was 60 years old, and I was half her age. I was 30, and I thought, what if half of my life is over? You know, what did I really want to do with my life? And I was an attorney by education and by profession, and I wanted to write, but I had never expressed that to anybody. And so I love movies, and I had a friend who worked at Disney, and I flew out to L.A. and met with him. He introduced me to a few producers, and I came away with the idea of, you know, that it's interesting that Hollywood is a place where you can be a nobody, but if you have something they want, they'll pay you for it. And so, you know, I thought, what did I have that no one else had? And I had a fairly unique upbringing with a brother with a muscular dystrophy, and we were always close. And so I thought, what if I, you know, maybe I could write a story about my brother and me. And so I undertook I went and bought books about how to write a screenplay. And I wrote a story. It was very autobiographical. And it was crudely written. It wasn't terribly good, but it got some attention. It almost got purchased for if you remember, after school specials at the time. And right. It gave me the energy to keep writing, and so I wrote a number of other screenplays. I developed contacts in Hollywood, and then I went back to my original story, and I rewrote it with the trip to see Roberto Clemente get his 3000th hit. And I had a friend, an actor friend, who actually was from Erie, Pennsylvania, Chris D'Annunzio, and he helped me rewrite it together. And I never had anyone who said they didn't like the story. And the problem was, I got frustrated because it wasn't getting made. So one morning I woke up and I said to my wife, you know, I know people with money, and I'm going to see if I can raise the money myself. And so I talked to some people, some friends who were financial people and investors. And then I had a friend who was a producer named Ryan Johnson, who always loved the story. He worked for Mandalay Pictures. He went out on his own. And I think I can raise the money. And so I was able to raise about close to $1 million. And so we were going to do a fairly small story, maybe write this video story of Chasing 3000. And Ryan lived near a person who was a manager, and one of the people she managed was Ray Liotta. And so Ryan got the script to his manager friend, who got it to Ray Liotta. And about 2 weeks before we started shooting in Pittsburgh, we still didn't have the lead cast, and Ray Liotta committed to the story. And it really took off, and it became a much bigger picture. We have a really great cast, and a lot of people wanted to then be in a Ray Liotta movie. And I was able to raise another $1 million because of that. So we raised with loans and investments almost $2 million to be able to film the movie. We shot it for about 6 days in Pittsburgh and then another 30 days or so in L.A. And a lot of this, basically the location's just doubling for traveling across the country. But so the story is based on my brother and me, set in 1972, and these two brothers take off across country in a race against time to see their hero Roberto Clemente get his 3,000th hit. And along the way, you know, the brothers discover the importance of being brothers. And it was just an incredible experience to get the story made. And, you know, it being autobiographical was even more of a surreal experience.
Well, Bill, Dave and I are both big fans of baseball movies, but when you combine a baseball movie with a good road trip movie, you really have something special there. You mentioned the cast. I mean, you really did have a great cast with that movie, with Ray Liotta, also Rory Culkin, Lauren Holly. I mean, it really seemed to all come together, and it told a good story that it's much deeper than a baseball movie, and, you know, it gets you to touch on some themes about relationships between brothers.
Yeah, it really is a story about the brothers, and their love of baseball, their love of Roberto Clemente, and, you know, how baseball is just part of, at least in our generation, about who we are and how we grew up. It's just part of, you know, our boyhood, and it brings back memories of that. But, we had a great cast. We were lucky to cast Trevor Morgan and Rory Culkin as the leads of the two boys. In real life, they were best friends. And so that's what's interesting, is it comes across. You can tell that the boys have this chemistry on screen that they, you know, in large part, Trevor and Rory were best friends. And so it really was special, you know. And Lauren Holly plays the mother. Seymour, the great and late Seymour Cassell, plays our grandfather.
Oh, Poppy.
And,
yeah.
Poppy, yeah. And and then we have M. Emmett Walsh, just an incredible character actor, Keith David, Michael O'Keefe. I mean, we had an incredible cast. People just couldn't believe the cast we had, and it just was a lot. Many, many people wanted to be in the movie, even though it was told in bookends, as we call it. So it starts in modern day with Mickey telling a story, and then it flashes back to the boys' trip, and then it comes back to modern, you know, the today's Pittsburgh and the two brothers. You know, we were just very lucky to have this cast to have you know, and one of the highlights of my life was the night, you know, Ray Liotta came into Pittsburgh, and I had a chance to sit down with him one-on-one. And it's interesting. Ryan Johnson, the producer, kind of warned me with A-list actors. He said, you know, one of three things will happen. Either he'll come in and he won't talk to anybody, he'll just go to his room. Two, he'll come in with a lot of changes, and you'll be up all night rewriting his scenes. Or three, he'll come in with notes and he'll talk to you about the story. Well, lo and behold, he came in with notes. We sat down and we kind of connected about the story. He himself told me he grew up, he was adopted as a baby, and as a little boy, and that he carried a little bit of a chip on his shoulder because of that, like Mickey in the story. And it was he gave me some notes about how he saw the character, and it was really an incredible experience.
Notes did he have that might have been different from what you originally intended?
That's a good question. let me think. I haven't thought about that in a while. One of the things, it's interesting, when you make a movie, I was always offended, if I digress for a second, when, you know, as I got better at my craft of writing, I would go to seminars and learn more about this, and meeting people, you know, people in Hollywood will call a screenplay a blueprint for the movie. And I always thought, well, that's much more than blueprint. And when you shoot a movie, it truly is a collaborative endeavor. And the director, the cinematographer, and the actors, they all lend something. And one of the things that Ray was concerned about was in the final scene, he said that I had him doing too many emotions, from bouncing from like happy to sad and then back to you know, and he said, you have me bouncing off of these emotions. Okay. He said, you've got to, what I think you should do is to, you know, keep the scene on a particular level. And so I learned that. That was something I didn't think of from the actor's point of view, having an actor attempt to, emotionally try to change maybe too quickly in the scene. And then he helped me see that from an actor's point of view. And I've taken it as you know, into my writing since then.
Well, Bill, one of my favorite quotes from a filmmaker is from John Sayles, where he talked about growing up, you know, he didn't want to be a movie director. He wanted to be an outfielder. And he said that everything that he had learned about style, he learned from Roberto Clemente. What was it that made you choose Clemente as a thematic part of this story between brothers?
Well, a lot of it really was based on our life. We did love Roberto Clemente, and for us who grew up in Pittsburgh and followed the Pirates, he was larger than life, and he transcended a lot of things. He transcended just his language barrier, his race, everything. We didn't see anything but this great ball player, and he was truly one of the, in my mind, maybe one of the top three or four outfielders of all time. And so it was a perfect vehicle for the hook is to, for the boys to get to see this 3,000th hit. And because Roberto's life ended so tragically, it also lends itself to just kind of an emotional pathos of the story. But Roberto was our hero. We loved him, and it was something that my brother and I shared.
Now, I assume you remain a baseball fan now.
Yes.
I got to tell you, one of my goosebump moments of the movie was when the cop pulls you over. Ray Liotta over when he's speeding, and just talking about both their shared memories of Clemente.
Well, that was actually a true story. It didn't happen to me, but to my friend. I grew up actually in Steubenville, Ohio, and my best friend Mark Stacy is a baseball coach there in Steubenville. And so quite a few years ago, maybe 12, 15 years ago, there was a documentary about Roberto on television. And Mark was on 22 in Pittsburgh heading to Steubenville. He gets pulled over by a cop. And the cop says, well, you know, what are you speeding for? And he said, I know it sounds silly, but I want to get home to see this documentary about Roberto Clemente. And then the police officer tells him this story about his sister. at the airport, and you know, got kind of you know, all of a sudden this emotion surfaced, and he told Mark, you know, get the hell out of here, and never gave him a ticket. And so that story actually, I think it resonates because it actually is a true story. And it is a great moment. It's a great moment by two great actors who, and they knew each other from the previous movie. They really had a mutual admiration for each other. Ray Liotta and Keith David.
There have been some great baseball movies like the Jackie Robinson 42 and also 61.
Yeah.
It still boggles my mind that there's not been a Clemente biopic at this point. I know that there was some talk with Disney, but it just didn't seem to go anywhere. You would think that would be a natural.
Yeah, I think they're trying to work on one right now, but it's interesting. It's not easy to Paul Thomas Anderson, the great director, filmmaker in Hollywood, he said it's a miracle that any movie gets made. It's very difficult to get a movie made, my latest project, oddly enough, is also another baseball story that I think you'll enjoy. It's called Brewer's Boys, and right now we pitched it to Amazon, and we're hoping to hear from them soon. But what happened with Chasing 3000 was that it was around the time Facebook came on the scene. People would watch the movie and they would reach out to me or my brother and say, hey, are you the Bill Makita that did Chasing 3000? One morning I woke up and I had a message from someone who said, hey, I saw your movie last night. I really loved it. And he said, I thanked him and he sent me another message. He said, I have a great idea for a movie. I played on the greatest high school baseball team of all time. I thought, well, so I gave him my phone number, and I could see his from his Facebook page, he was in Southern California. And so I called him, and he said that I played on the greatest high school baseball team of all time. That's fascinating. Tell me about it. He said, well, we won the city LA championship during the Watts riots. I said, the city's burning around you. Yeah. And you play the baseball game. Yeah. I'm in already. Right. And I said, just out of curiosity, who was on your team? And he said, well, there was Reggie Smith, Bobby Tolan, Bob Watts, and Doc Ellis. Whoa, wait a minute. Time out. You're telling me that all these future major leaguers were on your team? Yeah. And Dennis Gilbert? You mean the Dennis Gilbert who just tried to buy the Los Angeles Dodgers, Dennis Gilbert? Yeah. Short, white Dennis Gilbert. Yeah. So you were an integrated team. Yeah. And our coach was this really inspirational guy. His name was Chet Brewer. He was a pitcher in the Negro Leagues. And I was just blown away. Oh, and by the way, our 8-year-old bat boy was Eddie Murray.
Wow.
I mean, maybe the greatest switch hitting first baseman of all time. Yeah. He was your bat boy. Yeah. I mean, I'm blown away, right? I've never heard of this team. So I did my homework. I saw they all grew up in South Central Los Angeles. Sure enough, he's telling me the truth. So I optioned the story, and we met Dennis Gilbert, and the story just kept getting bigger and bigger. And as one of my writing friends said, it just kept writing itself. But it's this great story of this high school team who won the city championship during the Watts riots. Nine players, nine major league contracts.
Wow.
If you had two boys today on a team in Pittsburgh, it would be national news if two boys got major league contracts.
Yeah.
Right? Nine
right.
players. And it's an incredible story. My theory is right before the influx of all the great Latin players, Southern California was the nexus of the baseball world. Anybody who was anybody came out of us, L.A. It's fascinating. Chet Brewer coached 24 future major leaguers. He's one of the most fascinating baseball people that no one knows. And the story just kept getting bigger. You know, they said one day we came to practice and this tall, lanky, middle-aged man was throwing, was showing Doc Ellis how to throw a curveball. It was Satchel Paige. And
wow.
And then they said, well, this 24-year-old scout from the Dodgers, he came to all of our games, Tommy Lasorda? Yeah, Tommy Lasorda. And I said, who was did you have a team that you had trouble beating? Yeah. Who was their pitcher? Raleigh Fingers. It is the most fascinating. And then today they tease one player who was always hanging around, a skinny little kid who never made any of Chet Brewer's teams. His name, Ozzie Smith. It is one of the most incredible stories. And so I wrote the screenplay. It's got a great feel. It's a baseball story. It's a feel-good story. And it's a great story that nobody knows about, of all these great players who played on one team. Called Brewer's
amazing.
Boys. Yeah. So hopefully we'll try to get that movie made.
That sounds amazing. Before we go, this has been a fascinating half hour. Why don't you tell us a little about your brother and your relationship with him and baseball?
Oh, well, yeah, thanks for asking. My brother Steve has a very rare form of muscular dystrophy called spinal muscular atrophy. It's a particularly fatal form of muscular dystrophy. And these children rarely make it into their teens, and they rarely ever make it past 18. My brother, Steve, is 66 years old. He's the oldest person they know of with his disease. They study him.
Wow.
He's in a think tank. There's geneticists and orthopedic surgeons and scientists, and he's part of this think tank. He's, in other words, you've lived it, Steve. Tell us about your life and how, you know, what did your parents do? They look at other things besides just the science of it. But Steve was the first wheelchair student at Duke University. He is himself an incredible person. You could write a movie about my brother. He is one of the most fascinating people who overcame incredible odds and a disability to achieve. He went to college. He went to law school. He became an attorney and just recently retired. He's doing well. He's a little weaker. But he is doing amazingly well. And, my mother used to say, sometimes a child finds favor with God. And really, Steve is kind of a miracle, right? This child didn't die. This child lived. And he's a true inspiration. And a really good man.
Well, that to me, that's the most amazing part about this whole story. I just think that's amazing. I mean, thank you so much for coming on. Do you want
sure.
to tell people how to get a hold of you?
Oh, absolutely. You can send me a friend request on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but not a lot. Reach out to me on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and Chasing 3000 right now is on Amazon Prime. It's on Roku, Vudu. And this is the 50th anniversary year of Roberto's hit and his death. So we're hoping to do some big things in Pittsburgh and maybe with MLB to honor our legend.
Well, I'll tell you what, that would be perfect. Thank you so much for coming on. Love the half
hour.
Oh,
thank you.
And hopefully you'll join us again. I know there's so much more, we can talk about with this. But it's Bill Makita.
I'd love
to. If you haven't seen it, the name of the movie is Chasing 3000, and you will, without a doubt, be happy you did watch it. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it, and thanks for having me on.
You got it. Bill Makita. Chris, I'll tell you what, as we think about just how bad our baseball team has become, our soccer team is probably, along with the Pens, the most consistent winning team in the area. I know you're going to get to a Riverhound game this year.
I think I will. What a beautiful facility they play in. And, you know, it looks like from the things that I'm reading, Dave, this might be one of the teams to take a look at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They've had a good run. And the guy who does the best job by far in the city of telling their story for Pittsburgh Soccer Now, John Krasinski, is with us. John, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Real good. So this year, I've been lucky. We signed Duquesne coach's Keith Bambrot's son, I believe as a defender, if I'm not mistaken. And
that's right.
Tell us the new signings and why this team might finally have a chance to win the league championship this year.
Yeah, well, I think any time Bob Lilly is coaching a team, and we saw that even the first year he took over instantly, brought a certain level of credibility, earned the players respect, and, you know, with a Hall of Fame coach, I think that's where it all starts. And, of course, this year, Bob feels really good about where he is in terms of roster development and being able to, I think it all started with at the end of this, you know, unfortunate finish to last season where, you know, they had a lot of COVID positive players in the, you know, as the week leading up to the playoff game, and then they had to cancel the playoff game. That, you know, the off season being able to, sign about, I think that it was 11. They ended up re-signing 11. Actually, two of those, one Todd Wharton, and was ended up retiring. I'm just having a little throat issue here. But Todd Wharton retired, and then Ezra Armstrong, they actually sold him to the St. Louis MLS club. So there are actually nine players coming back from last year's squad, but then they've really built up, gotten some really good free agents. I mean, they went out and signed the all-time leading scorer in USL history, championship history, in Dane Kelly. Captain Canardo Forbes, he's Jamaican. He has, I think, had a good relationship with Kelly, and I think Bob Lilly and I talked to me about that. And, you know, Canardo definitely had a hand in helping convince Dane Kelly to come to Pittsburgh. There's a lot of, you know, what they did was they built upon the foundation from last year's team and have added to it with some really good players. So if you look at the roster, I mean, Albert Deak was back. Russell Cicerone, the team's leading scorer, is back. Canardo Forbes, as I mentioned, he's, you know, 5 years now with the Riverhounds. He's been with Bob every single one of his 5 years in Pittsburgh, and he was with him in Rochester for the, I believe it was the previous 4 years. So it's sort of like, I don't know, I'm Brady Belichick's probably a somewhat likable comparison, but they didn't go from one franchise to another together. But you get to catch my drift. So with Canardo Forbes, Bob has a field general, somebody out there who really knows his system, knows what he wants out there, and someone who can really, really, one of the great assets that Canardo has is he can, a player like that, once the ball touches his feet, he can really help dictate tempo and has a tremendous vision. And one of the unique things last year is that the Hounds were a pretty exciting, pretty high-scoring team. They moved Canardo up in the attack, and I think it helped a bit. And it added another element, another playmaker, another really good decision maker. So there you have that. And then obviously more players. Danny Griffin comes back. He had led the team in minutes last year. He's a holding midfielder. Even the back line, essentially you're bringing back all the starters from the three center backs in Mikael Williams, Shane Wheat, and Jelani Peters. So, and then adding to that, you mentioned Robbie Dambrot, one of the outside backs. He played 2 years in Loudoun. He essentially followed Wheat. We've got three former Pitt Panthers on the squad, so that's something, another thing Pittsburgh fans should be excited about. And I've written a lot about that on Pittsburgh Soccer Now, that there's three former Panthers. There's a little bit of a pipeline developing between Pitt's successful program and the Riverhounds. So there's a lot to be excited about. One thing Bob doesn't do is bring back keepers, it seems like. So he's starting over with a couple of young keepers. Chase Vosvik is, the last few games has started in preseason, so we'll see if he ends up getting the start, getting the nod. But it looks like a deep roster, a lot of veterans, and then some good young talent mixed in.
Well, you mentioned the keeper. I was going to ask you who they were going to pick for that. But it seems to me it's unusual for this team to have such a sense of continuity. And I think that's going to be a big thing. And like you, I'm looking to see what happens with Canardo Forbes. I just think that you called him the on-field general. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was talking to – in watching him play against Pitt the other day, I was talking to Mac Rubber, Riverhounds media relations manager, the director, and we were both talking about how important Canardo is. It's like having a coach on the field, someone who I'll tell you what though, if you really watch the games, you sit at a game at Highmark Stadium and you just kind of focus in on Canardo, you'll see him definitely doing what field generals do. He's definitely talking to the teammates in front of him. He's talking to his teammates behind him. He's more talkative than I thought. The last couple of years, I've watched him a little closer, and I've noticed that. I noticed he's definitely, a leader by example, but he's also, he seems kind of quiet and soft-spoken when you talk to him, but definitely on the field, he definitely is someone the players will follow, and he definitely has a lot to say.
Now, we get underway this weekend at Memphis. And the coverage, the TV coverage has just grown substantially over the years, whether it be 22, and I assume as in the past couple of years, you'll be able to see every game on ESPN Plus, which is a tremendous value at $5 a month. How has that exposure just helped this team succeed in the city?
I mean, I think it just gives them it provides second division soccer, and the Riverhounds have a forum. They have an outlet where, you can go and catch every game. Like you said, I mean, ESPN Plus has become really a go-to for a lot of different entities. Even I guess UFC now has gotten into the ESPN Plus zone, and you know, obviously all the college sports. I mean, if you're following anybody, any, you have any interest in one or two sports, whether it could be anything as random as college soccer or college baseball, obviously college hoops, any of those sports, you're going to want an ESPN Plus package. And but obviously the diehard soccer fans, you know, it's a great value. It's a super value, and the production value is pretty good. You know, there was a time when the Riverhounds were on YouTube, and those days, you know, production values weren't quite as good across the league. I would tip my cap to the Riverhounds team. You know, Chris DeVivo has been doing it for a long time, at least since they've been at Highmark Stadium, and he's done an outstanding. They have a pretty good, you know, team there, handles the production end of it. So it's you know, with ESPN, I think it just adds to the. It adds to the product. You know, it's a quality product, and that's something that people look forward to. Now, the league does have a relationship with, you know, ESPN, the worldwide leader, where they do broadcast X amount of games on ESPN2 and I believe ESPN Deportes. They have a national schedule. They, for whatever reason this year, the Hounds did not land on that, it was about 20-game schedule. So they might be playing with a little chip on their shoulder this year, some of those kind of getting slighted there. But, you know, they're still considered one of the important franchises in USL Championship. I still think that's actually an interesting discussion we were having on Twitter earlier this week with some of the other USL media people, and think the River, it's kind of clear that the Riverhounds and Charleston Battery, the two old guard franchises from the old original days of the A-League and what became the USL and then the USL Championship, you know, they kind of helped set the foundation, and they've kind of survived over the years, whereas there's a lot of newer franchises that have popped up. And some that have come and gone, some that have gone on to bigger and better things in the MLS. So the fact that there's a steady broadcast schedule, I think that's just another sign that this league has grown.
You mentioned last year the season winding down with a lot of positive COVID tests that happened there that affected this team. So for this season, what are you looking for? What would constitute a successful season for you?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, from my point of view, I posed this question to some of our contributors at Pittsburgh Soccer Now. We had this discussion on Pittsburgh Sports Live, and I asked the question, is it a disappointment if they don't go very far, if they don't have a really, really good season? Is it do or die type, you know, moment type of season for them, because, you know, they've come up short. They've had very good teams, very, very competitive teams, very good teams. But for whatever reason, the playoffs haven't been super kind. Last year was definitely cruel. They didn't get a chance to play the playoff game. The previous 2 years, their, you know, first round loss in 2020 to Louisville City, you know, obviously one of the top franchises. No shame in losing to Louisville City on the road, but losing to Louisville City at home 2019, when they were really poised, they were the top seed in the East, and actually at that point Phoenix had already been knocked out, so they would have been the top seed through the whole tournament and would have hosted every playoff game, including the USL Cup at home. So there's definitely that bitter disappointment of not having playoff success. They do have the 1-7 nothing win against Birmingham that in 2019 in the first round, but you know that he can hang their hat on that a little bit. But no, I think that there's a determination. As I mentioned, Canardo Forbes has been with the team for 5 years. You know, now Danny Griffin's in year three. There's some guys here that want to win badly. They came back to Pittsburgh to because they want to win a title. They know that Bob Lilly, you know, is the type of coach that can get them there. So there's a certain level of commitment and a lot of talent there that's capable.
But the league is it's tough. I mean, it's going to be tough. Tampa Bay Rowdies have won the East the last 2 years. They're going to be right in the mix. Louisville City is, you know, they have a brand new stadium. They're putting 14,000-15,000 people in there almost every night. That's competitive. That's somebody you've got to go through. The East is not going to be easy. Birmingham is an up-and-coming franchise. Miami is really good. So there's it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a grind. It's a 34-game regular season. They're going to be playing out of conference this year for the first time, which is kind of fun. They get to play some Western Conference teams, both on the road and home. So it's going to be a grind. You know, I always tell people, talk to me in June and July and August, because a lot of things can change between now and then. But one of the good things that Bob Lilly has done in the offseason, as I mentioned earlier, is that he's built a roster that I think he feels, whereas in the past he felt a team wouldn't miss a beat if they went 14-15 deep. He thinks that at this point he's at a place where he's about 18-19 deep in terms of field players, where he could just put anybody out, any one of those 18 or 19 players out there, whether, you know, if they have a midweek game and they want to play some different starters, he feels pretty confident that they can put out a very strong team.
Okay. This is a question I've oft wondered don't see it necessarily happening myself, but do you see this city ever becoming an MLS town?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the timing. Normally, I get that question all the time, and normally I have this sort of calculated same response, and that's, you know, I think the Hounds and the pro soccer here needed to get their act together first in terms of this level, this second division level. But now, you know, seeing the timing with Charlotte, obviously packing their football stadium in Charlotte with 75,000 people Saturday night in their first ever MLS home game. You know, this is a market that had drew less than the River had, you know, drew less than Pittsburgh. It would have drawn less than 2,000 fans a game in Charlotte during the last really 10, 15, 20 years. Charlotte has consistently had a second or third division soccer team, whether it was the Charlotte Eagles or the Charlotte Independents, never did well in terms of attendance. Maybe 2,000 was a good year in terms of average. So the Hounds have done better than that, but you know, the question is resources. You know, I think without Tuffy Schallenberger, the owner, current owner right now, I mean, we may not even have a Pittsburgh River Hounds to talk about. But that being said, you know, the difference in Tuffy and then, you know, what Charlotte has now is a billionaire owner who has the resources and can make it happen. So that's the question. I think Pittsburgh, if the right ownership came along, I think we, just like it's happening in Charlotte, just like it's going to happen in St. Louis, just like in Cincinnati, I think there's it's possible. I think I don't know at this point with competition, you know, the Penguins and the Pirates and the Steelers have such a history. And, you know, in a city like Cincinnati, where FC Cincinnati took off, you're essentially competing with the Bengals and you're competing with the Reds. There really wasn't that – they didn't even have a winter sport, you know, professional sports team. So, you know, that I think there was soccer's a little bit more in Western Ohio, I think Northern Kentucky. I think that there was a little bit more of an appetite for having a higher level professional soccer team. But, you know, Western Pennsylvania has shown tremendous growth. And since I've had the website, really I've had a couple, but since I've been covering it at this level where, you know, created a website to cover soccer in Pittsburgh, the growth has been time. And since the early 2010s has been pretty significant. And Highmark Stadium has something to do with it for sure, but also the growth of all the youth academies and it's the game in general in, on both sides, on the male side and on the female side. We've seen tremendous growth in the game in this area. And so, yeah, there's a chance that, you know, if they played their cards right, MLS. I don't know if MLS is going to keep expanding, though. I think they can only go so far. So then the question is, does soccer in the U.S. go promotion relegation like they do in just about every other country's domestic league in the world? But that's not going to happen because MLS requires such expensive expansion fees just to join the MLS. That's why I said the resources, the ownership, that's where it would come from. That's where it absolutely would have to come from. You'd need a $2 to $3 million investment just to get into the MLS discussion.
But one thing, though, that is growing is the tech sector here, and that seems to have an area with some affinity to soccer. So there is that possibility. Before, I always thought, well, I don't know that there's enough corporate dollars here in this market, but I think maybe there is now.
Yeah, I think that's change is constant. I work in Lawrenceville. I'm in that area. I've been at East Liberty all the time. You know, like you can see that, you know, there's the tech growth jobs and they're just in those areas alone, and the residential people living in the city. And, you know, we are becoming a little bit more transient. I think there is definitely soccer's, you know, if you look at the adult soccer leagues have grown, there's a lot of young people, young adults, young professionals that are, you know, want to keep playing the game that grew up playing it. So there's definitely that audience there. It's definitely grown from here on forward. I will always stick to my guns. I think I wrote this piece in 2016, 2015, somewhere in that ballpark, and said, you know, that this current franchise has to get its act together first. But that was coming pretty fresh off the bankruptcy time and some of their struggles that they were still going through in terms of organizationally and that sort of thing. And so I think they're at a different place now, and they've shown that they can have success on the field, but they haven't won any trophies yet either. That's another thing. So we'll see. But I'm curious to see where it goes. I mean, you know, obviously the college game, you know, college game, all the Division I college teams have gotten really marketed much better. Pitt and Duquesne men had a tremendous season last year as well. You know, Robert Morris is rebuilding, but I think there's only one way for them, and that's up. And on the women's side, it's the same thing. You know, it really is. So I think there's a lot of potential for the game to continue to grow. Where it goes beyond, you know, what the Riverhounds can do at this level, I don't know. I'm still, it's anybody's guess, but I think it'll come down to, as I keep saying, resources. You know,
well,
like
John, thank you so much.
There's a, you know, if there's some tech corporate, you know, some corporation or big deep pocket investor that's out there, you know, it's possible.
We thank you very much for coming on. I'm pumped up about the season. But before we let you go, a yes or no answer. Will we lift the cup this year?
well, there's a couple cups I think they're playing for, right? The Open Cup and of course, the USL. You know, the Open Cup, I would say, obviously, you got to play MLS team, so that's probably a no. USL Championship, I think that they are with the type of squad that they have returning, I think they have a very good chance to make a deep run. And honestly, I'm one of those people who believes that once you get into the playoffs, regardless if you don't have to be a one seed, but if you just kind of get invited to the dance and have a decent seed, then at that point, anything's possible. And I think with the way this team is built this year, I certainly think it's possible, and I think this is after what happened the last couple of years, a lot of disappointment. Don't
I think that's going to be that added motivation. This is a very, very motivated group. And because of that, I think they're going to do really well this year.
Damn.
So, yeah.
Look forward to it. Look forward to it. Look forward to it. I'm planning on being there on the 19th against Hartford. And thank you so much for coming on. Always enjoy it. There is no better place if you're a soccer fan to read about the sports than reading John Krasinski on Pittsburgh Soccer Now. Thank you so much for coming.
All right, David, thank you. Appreciate it, and really enjoy your work as well.
Thank you so much. John Krasinski.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Well, Chris, I can I have a minute here to vent?
Please, vent away.
Can you? You know, for the first time, you know my affection for the Cavaliers. Nearest team, favorite NBA team. A couple of years ago, the NBA decided to make Pittsburgh a blackout area for the Cavaliers, which means if I get NBA TV, it's blacked out. Those games there, if I order the subscription to watch the Cavaliers, I have to wait 3 days to watch the game. I finally got a chance with this exciting young team that they have. To finally watch him yesterday on ESPN. And for the life of me, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. You live 2 hours away. You don't watch this team on a competing station. I mean, nobody 2 hours away is going to buy season tickets to a basketball team. I've written them, and to a T, all they ever write me back is, yes, you're in a blackout zone. You cannot watch. Why would somebody do that? Why would that happen, Fletch?
I don't get it. You know, if anything, I mean, they've done studies on this, Dave. When you broadcast games, people go to games more often. So, I mean, it's just counterintuitive why they would do that. But one thing I will tell you, Dave, I'm gonna give you something. I'm going to accept your pain, but I'm going to tell you about my joy this week.
Please.
Watching the first episode on HBO of Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty.
How was it?
Docudrama about Dr. Jerry Buss, Magic Johnson, the Showtime years. First episode, I had chills. And the fact that, you know, how they were able to cast Quincy Isaiah as Magic Johnson, his first time acting, but, it's tremendous. I recommend it very highly.
I look forward. I get the subscription with our AT&T streaming service, but they have yet to tell me how to access it. So I'm going to do that. You fired me up to do that tomorrow.
John C. Reilly is a great actor.
Jerry Buss.
And he is Jerry Buss.
So he has nailed that, because I questioned that when I
saw
him.
Oh, he's nailed it.
I remember him as a catcher in the Kevin Costner film, For the Love of the Game, and he was a good actor, but he did not necessarily put himself among the greatest people to portray a baseball player.
Well, he's no Ray Liotta.
In the history of movies.
Even though Ray Liotta did
no
not bat the correct way in 8 Men Out, but that's okay. You know, he still looked athletic.
He still did. He still did. But he's more. Who was the guy in the Babe Ruth story?
Oh, William Bendix.
William Bendix. He wasn't as bad as William Bendix, but he's in the ballpark. Tony Perkins in the Jimmy Pearsall story.
Fear Strikes Out. Yeah.
Fear Strikes Out. He is the winner of the worst athlete ever to portray a baseball player.
Gary Cooper was no prize either. And the fact they shot that in a mirror because he could not simulate Lou Gehrig's batting swing, batting stance or anything like that. So they shot it through a mirror. He was actually left-handed.
Well, let's talk Gary's. Gary Busey in Rookie of the Year. You and I look better on the mound than Gary Busey did.
True. That's true.
Oh, my. Well,
Fun evening, Fletch. Next week, we're going to talk a little about our first NCAA basketball tournament, as you and I will be there on March 20th watching it. But we'll talk a little about the day that was in 1997, the first round of the NCAA tournament, first time ever in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, one of my great sports memories, I have to tell you. It was a marathon, though, and I don't think I was prepared for the marathon aspect of it.
It takes guts. It takes guts to go through four games and the drinking and eating in between. But anyways, we'll be back again next week, my friend.
All right, and you can catch us on our Facebook page, the 412. We'll have previews of the upcoming shows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Until then, you have a good night.
You as well, my friend.
All right. Good night.